Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and you're all very welcome. Dermot MacDonald with you this weekend. Our newspaper panel have been busy selecting the best and the rest from this morning's newspapers. But first, as always, let's have a quick look at what is making headlines today. This morning's attacks by the US against key Iranian nuclear facilities were too late to make the front pages, but there's plenty of analysis of the escalating conflict in today's papers. The Sunday Independent has a touching front page image taken by David Conaghy of the late Henry Mountcharles' wife Iona and son Alex, who are embracing each other outside Slane Castle following his death last week. For its lead, the Independent has conducted an investigation of the IRFU's property holdings, reporting close to 30 properties that have been bought by the Irish Rugby Football Union as it looks to build a hotel in Dublin 4. Revealed IRFU's multi-million euro Dublin 4 property spree. That's the headline there. But how rich is Leinster Rugby? That's the question explored by the Sunday Times in a two-page feature in its business section. But it reports for its main lead in the paper on a new set of personal injury cases taken by women who allege that their cervical smear tests were misread. The women's claims are separate from the original cohort of women identified in the original cervical check controversy back in 2018. The Business Post splash is an interview with developer Sean Mulryan, who has told the paper that tax breaks for developers are not the answer to Ireland's housing crisis. In the interview, Mulryan, who's the boss of Ballymore Properties, also says that he's going to transform Athlone into Ireland's first 15-minute green city in what's billed as his most ambitious vision yet. Ex-civil servants get sweetheart OPW rent deal is the lead for the Irish Mail on Sunday, which also carries an interview with Jules Thomas, former partner of the late Ian Bailey, who claims that his ashes were scattered in the wrong place earlier this week. The Sunday World leads with a report by Patrick Connell following last week's conviction of Marek Puska, brother of Joseph Puska, who is serving a life term for the murder of Aisling Murphy. Marek Puska, who was convicted of withholding information about his brother's involvement in the murder, said he believes his brother is innocent. The Sunday World also has a report that American singer Zach Bryan, we were talking about him yesterday, gave a €6,000 tip for three staff when he visited the Celt Bar on Dublin's Talbot Street last Wednesday night after he arrived in Ireland. The singer, who's going to play his third night tonight at Phoenix Park, that'll bring 180,000 people who will have seen him this weekend. He gave the staff the €6,000 tip after hearing how one of them was working late night to pay his college fees. Six teens drown in 6 weeks is the lead for the Irish Sunday Mirror. Pat Flanagan reporting that Water Safety Ireland is urging parents to warn their children about the danger of swimming after six children under the age of 18, including teenage basketball star Kofi Owusu, drowned in recent weeks. The Irish Sun on Sunday carries an interview with TV presenter Vogue Williams, and it's one of many papers that covers that seismic win over Limerick yesterday by Dublin's senior hurlers. 35 seconds that will haunt Limerick and will never be forgotten by Dublin, writes Tom Clancy on the game that saw the Sky Blues book their spot in the All-Ireland hurling semi-final. Across the Irish Sea, Iran dominates, with the Sunday Telegraph leading with the arrest of a British man suspected of spying on an RAF base in Cyprus for Iran. The paper also reports on a poll that suggests Reform UK leader Nigel Farage is on course to be the next Prime Minister after the next election, with a third of voters surveyed saying that they intend to back his party, and what a turnaround that would be. Well, joining me this morning is Donico Bacon, Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU, Philip Ryan, Head of Content with the Sunday Times, Kate English, Chief Economist for Deloitte, and Catherine Prasifka, novelist. You're all very, very welcome. Put your headphones on, because first of all, as we have been hearing in the news bulletins this morning, US President Donald Trump announced on social media last night that the US has entered Israel's war on Iran in an attack on three of its nuclear sites. This is a major escalation in the conflict between Israel and Iran. And let's get reaction from the Middle East and from Washington. First, let's go live to journalist and analyst Borzu Dagahi from the Middle East. Good morning, Borzu. How are you keeping?
Good, thank you.
Listen, did this attack come as a shock ultimately, obviously, we've been waiting all week. President Trump saying that he was considering an intervention and giving a 2-week timeline for his decision.
I mean, it was a shock. It was a surprise, only because Donald Trump said that he would make a decision in the next 2 weeks. He was going to ponder the issue. And it's kind of a shock that he was so gratuitously dishonest. And for what reason? You know, the U.S. has these B-1 stealth bombers that can bomb any location in the planet, figuratively in a moment's notice, and evade radar and so on, which has been very much degraded in Iran. All this does is make the U.S. seem really untrustworthy. And any word that comes out of Trump's mouth, already he's known for stretching the truth and bending the truth and not really having much loyalty to the truth. But on this such a critical foreign policy matter, it seems very difficult that he's going to get a diplomatic solution at some point.
Lookman, because last night we were hearing about the B-2 bombers heading across to the region. But how certain are we that Iran are in fact building a nuclear weapon, despite Donald Trump saying that this has been a spectacular success and attack on those three key sites?
Well, according to U.S. intelligence assessments and the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. It has the capability to do so if it so chooses, and it has enough enriched uranium, that is fissile material for a bomb, if it wanted to do so. But it has not progressed on several key aspects of building a bomb in over 20 years. So according to U.S. intelligence and the IAEA, Iran does not now have a real nuclear weapons program, though it does have a very suspicious constellation of nuclear technology sites that could be construed as a precursor to a nuclear weapons program.
So what do you think, Borzoi, is the real goal here for Donald Trump? Is it targeting the nuclear program? Is it regime change? Or some might argue, is it a distraction from things that are happening domestically at home, including the U.S. economy?
You know, it's really hard to tell. There was no imminent threat to either Israel or the U.S. with regard to any kind of nuclear weapon. There was no, you know, the timing of it is suspect. And also just the international climate, U.S. was in the middle of talks with Iran over this very nuclear program when Israel began its offensive. And, you can only speculate as to what Trump was thinking when he decided to join the effort. Trump seems to be mostly out for himself and his own interests. Perhaps he considered this an opportune moment to distract from his other problem.
Borzoi, before I let you go, what do you think, like, in terms of next steps? Do you think Iran can retaliate, or is very, very much in a weakened position in the region now?
I think Iran can retaliate. I think Iran probably will retaliate. The question is, how will it retaliate using the clandestine and subterranean means that it has used in the past frequently against U.S. and U.S. allies? Or will it opt for a more direct attack, as it did during the first Trump term when it hit a U.S. base in western Iraq in retaliation for the assassination of a key military leader? We can only speculate as to what Iran will do at this point.
Well, thank you for joining us, Borzoi, this morning. Now, from the Middle East to reaction in the U.S. and to WSHU Public Radio, Terry Sheridan, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us, which must be quite early for you this morning.
That's all right. Good morning, Daryl.
Look, obviously a huge escalation overnight. What has been the reaction so far in Washington? It was an executive decision. It did not go through Congress.
That's the big thing. Democrats in Congress are saying that Congress and Congress alone has the authority to declare war, which basically this is. Even though there was no war declaration, this was not a reaction in defense of anything that happened to the United States. So Democrats are saying, as they've been saying almost everything with the Trump administration, wait a minute, you need to consult us. This is one of our authorities. Republicans, on the other hand, are saying that this shows decisive action by the president. But we really don't know many details except the fact that there were the three locations. President Trump said they were successful, but we don't know how successful were things, how were things destroyed. So we're going to get more details from a press conference in about 2 hours' time at 8 a.m. local time here in the United States.
And again, just having spoken to Borza there, look, I mean, the view in the Middle East, what is the view in the U.S., do you think, of President Trump's goal with this intervention? It is, by any remarks, a spectacular strike, but when you're looking at actually what is the ultimate goal, what is the view there?
It's all speculation. Did he do it because he wants to strengthen his hand with Israel? Did he do it because he felt he wanted to appear to be decisive? Again, in the United States, there is still deep resentment from the Iran hostage crisis 45 years ago. Is this something that Trump's going to finally say, I finished this, I settled this once and for all? Or is it just something, as you know, it's been brought up, that this could be a distraction from the U.S. economy and all the other issues that the United States is facing right now?
One of the big questions I think that everybody's asking is, how are MAGA going to respond to this? Because this is somebody who, you know, rode into that second presidency on the promise that he was not going back into any forever wars and that he was it was going to be strength through peace. But the MAGA movement is divided.
Absolutely. And again, now this all happened at 8 o'clock, roughly 8 o'clock our time, local time, last night. President spoke at 10 p.m. It's 6 a.m. now in New York. So much of America has been sleeping. Much of America doesn't know this. But MAGA was divided, as you said, leading up to this, in that half of them were like, yeah, bomb, 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 bomb Iran is what their chant was. And the other half are like, wait a minute, no, we're trying to get out of wars. We don't want to get into any more wars, especially anything in the Middle East, especially when someone presents it as being a slam dunk, much like the Iraq war was presented to the American people.
Yeah, and had a long tail. Thank you very, very much for joining us this morning, Terry Sheridan from WSHU. Well, as I say, in studio with me are Donegal Bacon, Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU, Philip Ryan, Head of Content with the Sunday Times, Kate English, Chief Economist for Deloitte, and Catherine Prasiska, novelist. Donegal, I might go to you first of all, just as we're coming on air. Iran's foreign minister says he's going to Moscow to meet Putin. That's an extra dynamic in the mix, isn't it?
It is, but the fear that this might lead to World War III somehow is ill-placed. I think, you know, unfortunately, it's going to be a very difficult time for people in Iran in particular, but it's going to, I think, stay a regional war. Russia does not have the capabilities because of its own war in Ukraine, nor does it have the desire to help Iran, even though Iran has helped Russia a lot in its conflict in Ukraine. All those Shahed drones that were going into apartment blocks in Kyiv were made in Iran. But Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin, you know, spokesperson, said that while he said that the idea of regime change in Iran should not even be in the discourse, which of course is hypocritical since that's what they tried to achieve in Ukraine, he didn't give any indication at all that Russia was going to come on a white horse and somehow save Iran.
You picked out Vincent Boland's piece, Israel's War on Iran, a tragedy of civilizational proportions. That was in the Business Post. And what was really struck me about that piece, Donegal, was, you know, Iran as a population, what, of 90 million, two-thirds of which are under the age of 30, which is incredible. How do you think this will be perceived and received in Iran itself, which where many people are agitating for regime change as well?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that it's got a population of 90 million, because some of the most ardent supporters of regime change in Iran don't know that fact. That came out in an interview with Senator Ted Cruz, by Tucker Carlson. He had no idea what the population of Iran was. In terms of what the sentiment is in Iran, there's a lot of disillusionment with the regime. But those who would argue for regime change would need to show some positive precedents, because if you look at, for example, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, which was also about weapons of mass destruction, remember, which ultimately proved not to be true, it didn't turn out well. If you look at Libya, in fact, there are really no positive precedents. You have to go back to World War II, really, to find, you know, when Germany and Japan had military defeat. So I think that this may unite people rather than actually make them, you know, target the regime. It's very easy to enter a war rather than exit a war. What I liked about Vincent Boland's piece in particular was that he gave a historical context, particularly going back to 1953. This is the critical juncture in Iranian history, when they had a democratically elected prime minister who was taking on the Shah, the kind of dynastic dictator, and the British and the Americans orchestrated a coup
because they were going to nationalise the...
Because they were going to nationalise British Petroleum, what became British Petroleum. And that
put the Shahs back in?
That put the dictatorship back, and that led to a generation of built-up tension in Iran. And that cork just came off in 1979. Mm. And ultimately it was the fundamentalists, the religious fundamentalists, who gained power as a result of that. And what did the US do after that? Then they supported Iraq in taking on a major war against Iran. And the Iranians, of course, remember this as well. So anything that has kind of an American dimension to it is going to bring back memories of those things. And that's why, again, I would question those who are looking for regime change. It seems that that's what they want. And by the way, can I make one important point just about the motivation behind this, the nuclear weapons and the nuclear program? It seems that US intelligence, as was said, doesn't believe this. The International Atomic Agency doesn't believe this.
Is it another WMD?
Well,
moment?
This is it. Netanyahu has been pushing this since 1992, when he was a member of the Knesset. He said then that Iran was going to get nuclear weapons in 3 to 5 years. He then wrote a book 3 years later, Fighting Terrorism, where he made that claim. He's been making it at the United Nations. For 35 years, he's made a political career of creating Iran as a bogey. Now, that's not to say that Iran isn't a dangerous regime, but the idea that it's on the verge of getting nuclear weapons has been a claim that he's long made. And now he's found a president who's willing to believe him. And this is going to lead to, as Vincent Boland writes, you know, a tragedy of civilizational proportions.
Kate, obviously people will be thinking what it means for the economy, what it means for oil prices, not least Iran might be weakened, but there's a lot it can do. What, a fifth of the world's oil passes through that key strait?
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out in markets tomorrow. So what we would have seen last week, kind of as the conflict was escalating, was there actually wasn't maybe the fallout in markets as to what people would have expected. So if we think about stocks, so your S&P 500, NASDAQ, they ended their week the same way they began it. They're still up about 1.5% year to date.
Is that because they're pricing in the crazy, Kate?
I think it's more they were pricing in the fact that this will remain contained. It is not going to escalate much further. And therefore, what are the wider ramifications from a global economic perspective at the minute? Although we do not like to see this and it is worrying, they were operating off the basis of it will not spread further. As of this morning, you could argue that that has changed. So what will happen to those stocks in the coming days? Will we see a greater fallout of them? Oil took a little bit of a different move last week. So we did see it spike. It typically, for the last 2 months, has sat anywhere from about $58 per barrel up to about $61, $62. And it ended the week at about $78 per barrel. But it still didn't peak to levels that you might have expected. So if you think back to maybe
Ukraine
war, exactly. We saw it peak at over $122 per barrel there. And then we really felt that.
And is it the fact that the UK, through shale and fracking and everything else, has a much greater autonomy, do you think that gives it a confidence to not worry about that as much?
That's exactly it. There's a bit of a supply dynamic here also. We're also coming off the back of where oil prices have decreased over the past few months as global economic forecasts have reduced quite significantly because of changes to global trade policy. And there have been changes to supply within OPEC as well. So there's a couple of different dynamics at play within the oil market as it is.
And what do you predict will happen tomorrow morning when the market's open?
What a question. Don't pin me on a number. But I do. I think we'd have to see some form of market reaction to this. Today's move has taken people by surprise, and it does represent that escalation, which wasn't priced into markets last week, be it in oil or in that stock market. So there'll be some form of fallout. There has to be.
Catherine Francisca, you are a US citizen.
I am, yes.
And when you look across, we were, you know, discussing it actually with Jacinda Ardern yesterday about the fragility of the international rules based order. What do you think, reflecting on events early this morning?
I know, look, maybe it's me, like, you know, portraying my youth or whatever it is, but I kind of thought there used to be some kind of like agreed upon international standards that we stood by. And I think Trump has blown through all of them and created an incredible climate of uncertainty. I think that idea of like,
which
TACO,
is one of the big themes of all of your
it
of
is.
Your
we live in uncertain times, but I think that idea of TACO, like Trump always chickens out, really got to him. You know, he's a president that really can be
goaded. He didn't chick out last night.
He didn't, exactly. I think he wanted some kind of win anyway. And the executive branch has so much power in America, there's almost no checks on it. And he's the kind of president, you know, ask for forgiveness later and do whatever he wants. And I kind of wonder, is there any way to kind of hem him in? Because I'm not sure his base will either. You know, I think the MAGA base is incredibly difficult to predict, as is Trump. And I think there's no guarantee that they're going to abandon him now, at least if, you know, the conflict stays to airstrikes. I think boots on the ground is different, but...
Yeah, and would absolutely change it. Philip Ryan, the Keir Starmer this morning, the UK had nothing to do with it, but still perhaps a tacit support for trying to curb any development of nuclear facilities in Iran. The Irish government just saying de-escalate.
Yeah, look, this is all they can really ever do. We did get a press release early this morning, not long after the news websites put up about the attack, from Simon Harris saying he's monitoring the situation. And he's also meeting with EU leaders tomorrow, I believe, where one of the key things that will be discussed at that meeting will be about the UNIFIL mission, in where we have our only real peacekeeping mission at the moment. And what is the fate of that, and what will come of that in the coming weeks and months? Like, at this point, they are essentially sitting ducks over there, really, aren't they?
And yeah, hugely vulnerable. And especially after the big meeting in Geneva this week, you know, where is Europe, Donica, in all of this?
Europe, unfortunately, is a bystander. But then, as was rightly pointed out by Catherine, so is much of America. I mean, so is Congress. I mean, only Congress has the power to declare war. But it's a fun fact for listeners, but the US has only declared war 5 times in its history. The last time was in World War II, but the US has been involved in a lot of foreign conflicts. So it is also augmenting this monarchical type of rule that we see now in the US, which is a danger for us in Europe, because Europe is based on consensus. It's based on, you know, giving small states like Ireland an equal say in the big issues as much as Germany or France. And the way that people like, you know, Donald Trump and indeed Vladimir Putin and other strong men are dealing with world affairs is it the detriment of countries like Ireland?
And it's something, Philip Ryan, that Gerard Colleran picked up on in the Mail on Sunday when he was talking.
Yes.
One about the attention economy, how we all wake up to it every day. But he's saying that he said that the suspicion that these two strong men have cut a deal, Putin leans in harder on Ukraine and Trump can join Israel against Iran without risking Russian involvement, shouldn't be ruled out.
Exactly. And the headline there is, it's Donald Trump world and we're all just living in it. And I just feel like that sometimes. Like, he just dominates the news. He puts on these performances, which are borderline stand-up comedy, it feels like sometimes.
He's
like
a TV president.
Exactly. He's in the middle of all this going on, was it last week, he's decided to spend 45 minutes putting up flagpoles in the White House and hung around with all the press to do it. Mm. And it is like, I don't think this idea that he's trying to distract from things, I think he wants all the attention on him, and everything he does is to get that attention.
Can I ask you about it? Because Gerard Colleran also picks up on that interview between Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz about the MAGA base. That's 2 hours of my life that I'm never getting back.
I watched it as
But it was absolutely fascinating.
Was.
And Philip, the viral clips don't really do it justice because you can just see that real struggle between the isolationists and those, you know, who are, you know, the America first. It was fascinating.
I'm glad you don't apply Tucker Carlson's interview techniques, because my God, he doesn't hold back when he's getting stuck in. And at times it sounded like two guys at 2 a.m. standing outside.
Whoever said women are emotional should watch back.
But it was interesting to see the breakdown of MAGA world, though, on the two different fronts. Of Trump came in, he promised end of the forever wars, like you said, isolationist policies. People go on about Trump being a monarch and all this, but like, Obama was a warmonger. There's been Democrats who've been warmongers over the years, and lots of people have died at the hands of US presidents, which are seen as, you know, the more appeasing ones to people. But
Gerard Colleran says that the biggest threat to Trump is, in the event that he openly joins Israel and Iran, which has obviously happened overnight, will come from his own hardcore MAGA base. Do you agree, Donica?
Potentially, but he's made a calculation here, other columnists have suggested, and he thinks that he can ignore them for now. For me, the most worrying aspect of this is that there's a large constituency in America who believe in some kind of divine mission for the United States, and that Donald Trump is somehow a messenger of God, as one Israeli, actually, government minister put it this morning. And that really came out in that interview with Senator Ted Cruz. I mean, he quoted the Bible, he quoted Genesis, texts that are thousands of years old, to say that this is a reason why
Benjamin Netanyahu's government should be supported. He didn't know the exact bit in the Bible. I think Tucker Carlson Carlson had to come in and
actually,
give him a bit of a dig.
When Tucker Carlson's the smartest guy in the room, you know you're in trouble.
Can I ask you, just before we go to an ad break, separate but perhaps a little bit related, Catherine, the Sunday Independent had a piece about a 25% drop in Irish J1 arrivals to the US amid social media vetting.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly scary, isn't it? You know, it kind of cracks down on free speech. It looks into your personal life. You're supposed to turn all your social media profiles to public, and they're advising you not to just delete them. You know, people have said to me that they're going into America with burner phones and putting their real phones in their suitcase and things like that. I think that really shows this kind of... you know, what Trump's very good at doing is owning narrative. And I think that's how he appeases his MAGA base, by kind of selling them an idea, winning hearts and minds. And then whatever policy he does doesn't really matter if it doesn't affect them. And I think he's a social media president, you know.
Anything that makes people think twice about what they put on social media is probably not a bad thing either.
True.
On that, we'll take a very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. Well, with me in studio this morning, Catherine Persifka, novelist, Philip Ryan, head of content with the Sunday Times, Donegal Bacon, professor of politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU, and Kate English, chief economist for Deloitte. Not much of an economic aspect, or perhaps there is, Kate, but a lot of coverage again this week in the papers about the presidency. Brenda Parr, I think you picked one out. Contenders know top job can bite them in the arse.
Yeah, as you said, it was covered quite a bit across a number of the different publications. But Brenda Power, I think, as she, a very stark actually line she had in her piece was, is it possible anyone who is clever enough to run for president isn't stupid enough to run for president? Mm-hmm. And that's quite a strong statement, but she's pulling on the fact that with 4 months to go, nobody has officially declared. And on the contrary, she said a stampede has been in the opposite direction. And I think that rings quite true for what we've seen in recent weeks. I suppose there is another element at play here too, of where, you know, party political focus probably hasn't been on the presidency. As we saw, Dáil was trying to get, a new government was trying to get underway at the start of the year. We obviously saw delays in setting up the committees due to ongoing rows around the speaking rights. And it feels like we have a government that's kind of only almost just really got up and running in the last number of over weeks or a month or so. So I think that has taken some of the focus away. The election has to happen, so we will see a shift in that focus over the summer period. But it's who will come forward, and it's that wider question of, well, why? Like, why is no one?
And the answer, possibly, Philip Ryan, is because 2011 was such a bloodbath when we did have a stampede. Was it seven candidates in that? And just a lot of the commentary. I know Mary Regan in the Sunday Independent, Shadow of 2011, bloodbath hangs over the race for the Irish, but pointing out the vitriolic attacks, the personal attacks, and people suffering not just kind of the normal cut and thrust of politics, but actually being traumatised by the experience.
Yeah, but you can look at it the other way as well, in that we've had some pretty popular and good presidents. So did all that
Does the end
campaign
justify the means?
Well, like, yeah, did we weed out the bad ones and we got what we needed in the end? And like when, like our last three presidents, like you're talking Michael D. Higgins, Mary McAleese and Mary Robinson, like it's not bad as far as leadership goes.
But when you look at that level of scrutiny,
we could have ended up with, like, I mean, would any some of us others.
But when you look
as
at
actually
that,
Brenda points out in the Sunday Times, the only three running at the moment are Linda Martin, maybe Conor McGregor and Pat Casey. So,
but the fact is that they're not really running because they need that 20 TDs or four councils, and they're not going to get it. They've declared themselves.
I just kind of wonder, would any of us survive a couple of minutes of the opposition research, given the level of scrutiny that goes? Kate, you spotted one, I think, Anton Savage in Life, which in the Business Post, presidential campaign bloodbath appeals to no one but McGregor.
Yeah, so it's that piece of, if we only have one candidate really declaring themselves as running in the race, we have a problem. And it's back to that question of, well, why? You know, it's that piece of the reputational risk. Is there high personal cost of a public life? limited executive power? What's your cost versus benefit? Not to make it a, like an economist, but of taking on such a role. And it is detailed quite in a number of different pieces today around, you know, the well-salaried, the benefits as such that come with it, but that the cost
prestige
is what,
and it's an important constitutional function as well. Catherine, you had, I think Eilis O'Hanlon had a piece in the Sunday Independent. Now he has all the answers. Does Leo plan to go from pub war to president? And she's suggesting perhaps that former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, when he's out talking on big issues like unity, etc., that maybe he doesn't want to retire from public life. Do you think your generation would support
I don't think necessarily, but I think we're less interested, I suppose, in who then what. You know, I think it doesn't necessarily matter who's coming forward, but what they're actually talking about. And my big fear with the presidency is the kind of national platform it grants people. So I'd be very particular about what people are bringing up, because there are probably a number of issues that are bubbling beneath the surface in Ireland that on a local level probably wouldn't get that much attention, but they could be polling at 5%, 7%, 10% nationally. And if we raise issues up on a national stage, things like immigration, give voice to those, but we don't necessarily control the narrative, or we let someone like Conor McGregor do it, we basically cede that issue and we allow every party to kind of take or be forced to take a stance on it. And I think things like that can open the door to the far right.
We famously didn't allow the under 35s to run for presidency. That was kicked down. Do you think that was a mistake? Do you think there could have been some
Well, look, I'm less concerned, as I said, with the ages of the candidate than what they're bringing forward. I don't necessarily think that, you know, young people would have the experience necessarily needed, but I do think they should be listened to at least in some kind of level.
Philip, Leo Varadkar obviously has been out in the public domain quite a bit in recent times. Do you think that the economy, other things might be forgotten and that he could be a potential candidate?
I don't think he'd have any real interest in getting back into that kind of cut and throat of politics at this point. I think he prefers the role he has now as kind of a commentator, which was, I suppose, what he was always accused of being when he was at Taoiseach as well. But it doesn't seem like he would want to throw himself back into all that. And he has a book coming out, and that's kind of coinciding with the election. So you can imagine everybody trawling through that if he decides to put his name forward as well.
So, Donegal, or maybe ask all of you, do you have any ideas of who would be a good candidate? Some interesting names beginning to float around, including Geraldine Bernaysen over in the US.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't hear that, but that she would be a good candidate, definitely. I mean, there is something there in, actually it was in Miriam Lord's piece yesterday in the Times, where she mentioned that, yeah, you need that kind of diplomatic skill to be, you know, head of state. And she mentioned actually Mike Ryan as a candidate. He's been apparently courted by the left.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because you need to have that diplomatic and that kind of, you know, grandee status, but you also, someone else pointed out, need to be able to fight really dirty in order to get there.
And it's not surprising that it is dirty, because, you know, there is a lot at stake. It's the only national election we have. You're supposed to embody the nation. People take that quite seriously. And there's no power really attached to it. So it does come down to, you can't talk really about policies because you don't have the power to implement them. So it does come down to your personality. And that's why, you know, all the parties are struggling. Fianna Fáil haven't run presidential candidate since 1997. Mary McAleese was their last candidate. And some of them think that's a good idea because they're very expensive as well. That puts off independence, about half a million to run a successful presidential or even an unsuccessful presidential campaign. I heard Simon Harris on Clare Byrne earlier this week, and he was the only one going into some detail about their plan, which was that in early July they will have an open call. Mairead McGuinness is the name most mentioned, though she said she would rule herself in or out by May. It's now you know, almost July. And if there is no other, if there's only one candidate, they can more or less campaign from the end of July. If there are more than one candidate, then it's talked about early September. The left seem to be having all sorts of contortions
about
whether
potentially a name that was being floated about. Our listeners are very keen to give their views. Len says Bob Geldof, and Aoife said Mike Ryan is the only credible name at present. Catherine Pacifica, can I bring you in just on a related issue? Because there's quite a number of pieces today about the online abuse and abuse of politicians. And I know, obviously, that there was the Tattlelife, the issue earlier this week, which sort of does bring up that, I suppose, that phenomenon of online abuse, which is a huge deterrent for anyone embracing any role in public life or indeed private life and business too.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when you are a public figure and you have a social media presence, you are open to an incredible amount of abuse, but also people who are relatively private individuals, not necessarily even celebrities. Maybe they have a couple thousand followers on Instagram, and suddenly there are websites like this where people can anonymously leave an incredible amount of hate. They can kind of dox you. That's when they kind of release public information about you, where you live, where you work, that kind of thing. And I think that's something that we're not necessarily really prepared to deal with. You know, how do we treat these websites? Are they publishers? Are they not? Should they be forced to give up the information from these people who are anonymously posting? The harms are real and they definitely exist, right? But I suppose, what do we as a society do about it? And I think people are emboldened when they are anonymous to just post things.
And they're emboldened when they're not held to account. But obviously that was quite a significant ruling in the North, and quite a significant amount of money as well. Philip, both John Deasy and John Lee are writing about abuse of politicians. And John Lee in the Mail on Sunday was talking about, you know, graffiti on the Taoiseach's office wall in his constituency. And he's saying, you know, it might appear insignificant, but in fact, it could be a precursor, as in the US, to potentially darker things.
Yeah. And look, I think the people that do this type of stuff, that they're not, I don't think it's really organised, and I'm not sure how together or there they really are. Because he's writing on, or whoever wrote it, wrote on Micheál Martin's office down in Cork that he's a Zionist pawn. Now, we're in one of the few countries in the world where the Israeli ambassador has left and closed down the embassy. So if he is a Zionist pawn, he's just not doing a very good job of it. But it does seem, and I think a huge amount of it is the social media. It's firing this, it's driving these people to come up with these kind of views, and then they can go online and the algorithms will reinforce their thoughts and they'll get other people sitting in anonymous in their basements, in their boxers, typing all this
but
stuff.
As we know from other movements, you know, all the incel and other kind of far right movements, is that online abuse can trend, and we've seen it in our own
course here,
female journalists and others here. Do you agree, Philip, with John Deese's proposition that the abuse of politicians favours yes men over honest, effective lawmakers?
Yeah, and populism, it affects populism. Whatever the issue of du jour online is, that the politicians go, oh, jump up and down, well, we better make sure that these people are being satisfied. But it doesn't. The anonymity that's offered to people on the internet just has to end. Like, it's caused nothing but problems.
And it's Kate, I know you spotted again, I think it was in the Sunday Independent, Julia Maloney's piece, Tattlelife Win is a Small Step to a Kinder Internet. I would have thought it might be a microscopic one. But that has been very, very interesting, that case.
And I think, even as Julia Maloney pointed out, because a lot of people listening today may not have actually heard of Tattlelife until about a week ago. You know, it sits in a sphere that some people are very aware of it, but an awful lot of people aren't. But yet, as Julia Maloney pointed out, they have 12 million monthly viewers of the site, which shows the sheer scale of a site that, as again she says, the tagline for it is a site for commentary and critiques of people.
And the irony was that the owners, until unmasked in Belfast, had themselves been hiding behind a cloak of anonymity. It does, Donica Barkin, though, does create a much, much more febrile and kind of dangerous atmosphere for politics and public life in generally.
Oh, absolutely. It does, and it will influence the type of person who goes into politics, because we have a two-tier system at the moment. We have, as you know very well, there's a certain standard and law for TV, radio and print media, and then you have the unregulated Wild West. And it's just remarkable how restrictive it is, what you can say in the print and audiovisual media, and how much you can get away with in the anonymous world of the internet. And it is having a toxic effect on politics. There's no question about that. And this is why, by the way, you're seeing an attack on this from the US, from Trump and Vance and people like that. They talk about freedom of speech. The only body, I think, that has the power to take on this on a really international level is the EU. It has to be done at an EU level. No national government can do this by themselves.
Yeah, but of course, and big cultural differences with the US as well. Our listeners are very, very keen with their ideas on who should be the next president. Before we take our ad break, Noel says Bernadette McCallisky would be a great president. Another says Peter Casey, Catherine Connolly, Evie Solomon for president, as Fionn, Theo Dorgan was another suggestion, and another said Emily O'Reilly. So there are plenty of suggestions out there. The question is, will they come forward? But we'll take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Very welcome back. With me are Catherine Prasifka, Kate English, Philip Ryan and Donica O'Bacoin. And we might move to housing. Kate, fellow developers of Sean Mulryan might be clutching for their pearls this morning because he has recommended that tax breaks are not the answer to the housing crisis. So a little bit of out of step, perhaps, with others in the industry. That's a piece, that's the lead story in the Business Post this week.
Yeah, so front page of the Business Post, developer tax breaks are not the answer to the housing crisis, and instead he quotes that we need to get more land zoned and infrastructure delivered in order to deliver housing. And we see something quite different in the Sunday Independent, where Fergal O'Connor wrote that the building sector wants VAT abolished on apartments to boost supply, and that's coming from a CIF, so the Construction Industry Federation survey that was out recently. And I suppose there's probably a bit of truth in both here. Sean Mulryan has a very clear point when it comes to the need to zone more land and ensure that infrastructure is being delivered. We cannot meet our housing targets without having energy, water, roads there as well to connect to those houses or apartments. But I do think, and we're going to see a bit more of this come out over the next few weeks, of there is potentially a role for VAT to play as a lever. And we all know.
Fergal O'Connor does note that he said, but a move to abolish VAT in the new apartment sales is unlikely to see the market price of units drop, because prices would still need to remain high to bridge the viability gap. So every choice sort of comes with a trade-off.
I suppose that the choice here as to what they're pointing out is that the VAT reduction is all to, or abolishing of it, whatever is taken in the end, is to try and deliver supply. I suppose they're arguing that costs are too high, there is a viability gap, and what levers can be pulled to reduce that gap in order for the units to be delivered in the first place. It's not a case of what price they will be delivered at. The choice is, will they be built at all? So I do think there is something there, and it'll be interesting to see how it's discussed further by government in the few weeks.
Philip Ryan, there's a lot of very good articulation of the problems and what needs to be done, but the other viability gap, or perhaps the credibility gap, is the implementation.
Of the many, many policies that keep getting announced every couple of weeks. And I think Sean Mulryan makes that point as well. It's just, there's too many people involved, there's too many policies, and the basics aren't being done well. And the basics are, and I've kind of experienced this myself, getting water connected and getting electricity
connected. You bought recently enough, did you?
In the last year or so, yeah. So like that, getting that done is a huge problem and takes months and months and delays. And that is a core thing. To have a house, it's good to have water and electricity.
Yeah.
So it's and it's extraordinary that we are at this point. Ishga Erin is a struggle, and then getting on the grid is a struggle as well. I thought the most impressive thing about Sean Mulryan, though, is in the last paragraph, where he says he, at 70 years old, he gets up every morning and goes to the gym and does a workout and some yoga.
Yeah. Very impressive. Yeah. Catherine, I think you'd love to have Philip's problems with it, just worrying about whether you had
I know a lot of young people would take a house without electricity and water, you know.
How would you get on your Wi-Fi to go out about it?
I think you picked out a piece by Shane Coleman, you know, who said, he was saying, just do what needs to be done. And he's saying that we've become accustomed to enough muddling through, but a crisis arises now because that long-standing inability to deliver major public infrastructure is threatening to have disastrous implications for our economy, and perhaps even by extension our democracy.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, this is an existential issue that I think we need to start talking about seriously. Not that we aren't already, but one thing that I've noticed, I think, is that people can't quite conceptualize what it is to be in your 20s and trying to move out of your parents' house. You know, this is an issue that affects everybody. Parents don't want their 35-year-old daughter living with
them. They also don't want their house prices to drop.
Well, indeed, right? But the fact of the matter is that it has to happen, right? Like, most people are paying about $1,000 a month to live in a room, in a share house, normally with strangers. Probably doesn't even have that good electricity anyway, you know? And I think, you know, people think, oh, like young people, well, they're happy enough to do that. But we're talking about people, you know, in their late 30s who are living the lives that students might have been living before, and students now, like I work at Maynooth and I have students who commute 3 hours for lectures because they can't afford to live in the area, you know? So I think there's two issues here. There's obviously supply and there's cost, right? So increasing supply is good, but what are we supplying and can anybody afford them?
Kate, it's interesting. Shane Coleman also says it begs the question, it's been asked before, could Dublin Airport, Ardnacrusha or the Conseil Gas Pipeline, all essential pieces of infrastructure, be built today? And one of the things he identifies is the lack of multi-annual funding for key state companies as well as planning. But once you get into planning, then you're kind of talking about compulsory options that everybody kind of goes, oh, no, that couldn't possibly be done.
There's no getting away from it that this is a complex issue. There's many different stakeholders and layers to deliver on infrastructure, including housing, if we layer it in with that as well. We've seen a lot of movement on planning over the last year with the enactment of the new Planning and Development Act. How that actually plays out in the market, we're yet to really see. But it's certainly all those planning delays that are there, they add to costs, be it the cost of delivering a large-scale infrastructure project,
or resubmitting
such as
the application itself,
or houses or apartments. And I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of what are we trying to do here? We released a Crane report earlier this week as well, looking at development activity within the residential and wider commercial property market. And we're simply not building enough homes. Completions this year, we estimate to be 33,000 homes, but we need between 50,000, over 50,000, and the government's targets are at 60. And it's back to that part of how do we pull as many levers as possible that reduce viability gaps, that therefore allow units to be delivered. The only way affordability will be addressed is by delivering supply, supply, supply. Without that, we're going to continue to see really strong affordability constraints in both the home ownership market and the rental market.
There's all the tinkering, though, putting off investors because they don't really know what the Irish market they're investing in
because
it changes every couple of weeks.
Do you think these investors, you know, they're not going to invest at a point at which rent is going to come down, actually, because they'll lose out in their investment? So we can't only rely on them.
But the private market also acts very strongly or helps to deliver social and affordable homes as well. And I think that's a message that's often missed in the public domain. We know, again, a report estimates that we need 9.9 billion to deliver social and affordable housing targets up to 2030. Not all of that comes from state finance, and the private market builds a lot of social and affordable homes. So you cannot, we will not deliver on housing targets and requirements unless you have a functioning public and private sector.
Definitely, I agree on that. But we need to also make sure that the average rent isn't costing basically 100% of someone's disposable income. Like, that's not viable at all.
Yeah, and also that disproportionately affects those actually trying to get on the ladder. In the middle of it all, Catherine, is climate, which seems to have fallen way, way down the agenda. And you spotted, was it a piece by John Gibbons in the Business Post?
Yeah, about how we can't keep, you know, what was the headline? You can't keep lauding them as
captains of industry. Yes, we must stop celebrating climate destroyers as captains of industry.
Absolutely. And you see that with, I mean, to bring in another issue, AI, you know, this thing that's going to come and innovate and change all of our lives while also destroying the planet and taking all of our water. So we're talking about infrastructure, you know, that comes into that as well. And I think so often we forget the environmental impact of innovation.
It's up to you. Consciously or subconsciously channel when you're writing your fiction, which sort of has that
thread absolutely. Of... I think, you know, there are a number of issues that are all very much interlinked, including the environment, including housing, including cost of living, that I think everyone, every artist is trying to articulate at the moment, and that I think is on the minds of every young person in Ireland.
Yeah. Philip, I might just chat to you about immigration. There are a couple of pieces this week, but obviously the acquisition by the state of City West, one of our kind of biggest hotels this week, has raised quite a bit of interest. You spotted a piece by Ona Malley.
Yeah, Ona Malley was drawn the comparison between the decision by the government to buy a hotel, which feels comical in a way. Like, why is a government buying a hotel?
Like, well, we had paying a lot of money to maintain
anyway,
the people
I know,
in
but
the
it's
hotel.
Just state-owned hotels just sounds like the most bizarre concept
was
I've
it,
ever heard.
Well, is it a state-owned hotel or a location to receive asylum
seekers?
That's
what it's going to be, though, yeah. But it just the fact that we are at that point of society where we're buying hotels for immigration centres, it just seems bizarre. And he was drawing the comparison between that and what's going on in Denmark, where they're reducing immigration almost to zero, and they're just not taking
people
in.
Well, you can't. No country, including Ireland and Denmark, can negotiate
like
away
its
right to receive, or its obligation, rather, to receive asylum seekers. So does this not, considering that site has been used for that purpose, that it makes sense rather than spending, whatever, 70 million a year?
I think they need to do something different with immigration. Like, the hotel was once a viable hotel. Like, let's look into why that's the case. Why has it suddenly become a situation where we now put as many people as we can into it? There was a situation before down in Tipperary, was it Ross Cray, where they moved people into an abandoned hotel again as an IPAS centre, but then promised the local people they'd buy another hotel and open it up for them.
Isn't it better that the government ensures that, you know, these centres are fit for purpose and not abandoned hotels? And if there is a problem with there not being, let's say, a hotel in a small town functions as a community space, as a place to hold communions, as a place for people to come and visit, if you're relying on the private sector to provide these community spaces, they're always going to go where the profit is. So there needs to be more public investment. But we do, as you said, we have international obligations to accept refugees.
Yeah. Sorry, Phil.
But I just think we like very much have buried our head in the sand on this issue for years and years on the immigration side. And everybody looked down their noses at England when the debate raged on there. But like, we are at a capacity. We've been just talking about the housing crisis. We're at a situation where we've had a housing crisis for 10 years. And then over the last 2 to 3 years or whatever it's been, we've decided we've done nothing about really the vast amount of tens of thousands of people who are coming to this country to live. Like, that just doesn't balance well.
There's a big difference between asylum seeking, legal migration, and the whole lot. But,
sure, but the people who are seeking asylum are in the tens of thousands that are coming here.
Well, it's reducing. And of course, we had the Ukraine crisis as well. So there has been a lot of pressure on the system. There was a lot of pressure, Donnacha, last night on Limerick. Were you tuned in to that? The Conor McKeown in the Sunday Indo has shock and awe. Did you tune in?
I did, and I was delighted for Dublin. I'm a Clareman myself. I know what it's like to wait a long time.
You have felt that pain.
Yes. We were 81 years waiting for an All-Ireland, and I remember even in 1993 interviewing a guy called Tom McInerney, who had been on the last Munster winning team in 1932. So, you know, the psychological breakthrough, it lifted the entire county. Many counties have gone through that in recent times. But Dublin, hurling's always been the poor relation. And as a blow-in, relatively speaking, I live in Glasnevin. Nafina is my local club. They are now the All-Ireland hurling club champions. And that didn't come out of nowhere. I went to the ones where they were defeated in the build-up. My daughter trains there, for example. They are like a machine. The dedication, the number of the hundreds of teams. So this didn't come out of nowhere. And there was that dismissiveness in advance. I looked at Nicky English's column in the Times yesterday. He says, Limerick are obviously happy to get a run out in Croke Park at this stage. And to be fair to them, it's hard to see any great jeopardy in their quarter-final against Dublin. So, you know, I'm very happy for Dublin.
Kit, you got to see it too.
I put my hands up. I'm at fault here. I didn't watch the match yesterday, despite being a very strong hurling supporter, proud Tipperary woman. So hurling is in our blood. But I didn't watch it because I thought it may be a walkover and that Limerick would
ye of little faith.
But this is why you gotta love sport. expert. It throws up so many surprises.
Speaking English.
Yeah. No relation.
Catherine, did you see the match?
I saw it, yeah. I'm a recent convert to watching hurling. My boyfriend's a proud Cork man and he insists I watch it. But I will say, out of all the... I mean, I'm not a big sports person. I don't like things that raise my heart rate. Yeah. But out of every sport that I've ever seen, hurling is the one where, like, heart and kind of commitment to the game seems to actually play out on the field.
Yeah. Can I ask you just about, there was a mad little piece about tarot cards and and this is sort of TikTok and kind of social media, but people charging up to 185 euros per reading.
Yeah. And like the algorithm on TikTok is so specific that it basically knows exactly what's going on in your life. So if you're going through a breakup, it knows about it and it pulls up a tarot reader saying, he's coming back, you know.
And then you go down a very bad rabbit hole.
Who wrote a piece in the Sunday Times actually said that's exactly what happened to her after she started researching it.
Philip, before I let you go, I have to ask you, because we both used to work very close to the Celt Bar on, on Talbot Street. Good one if you were there the other night, Zach O'Brien, dropping $6,000.
Well, I woke up to what Zach O'Brien's fans left near my road last night with cans and food and everything. But yes, I also know the Celt Bar. Been in there once or twice, I have to say. And yeah, I can understand where he's coming from. It is a great little bar and it's good fun. I think Tregus is the barman.
Well, the best bar in Dublin, according to Zach O'Brien. But I'm afraid that is all we have time for. My thanks to Donico O'Bacon, Philip Ryan, Kate English and Catherine Prosesco for joining us for the panel this morning. Just coming up to 12 o'clock. It's time to go for the news and weather and to Kit Carolyn.